All right, welcome back to Sense Space. Past Future Education is the provisional name I've given to this wonderful dialogue that's begun between Tim Kubik and OG Rose, and we are already well into the thick of exploring education, particularly around the themes of attention and the way that education is structured today, in which you are asked to move from class to class to class, from topic to topic to topic. And what does this actually train? What quality of attention is being trained? Are we being trained to become effective to-do list doers rather than deep thinkers? And is the student who continues to contemplate what happened in first period and fifth period a bad student? Or are they actually holding a greater potential? And I'd love to explore that further. I also want to presence, I think, a deeper context in which we come into education, which is almost always prefaced as we are coming in here to receive. I'm going to come in here and I'm going to receive the information. You come to school to receive the learning from the teachers. You don't come to the school for the teachers to learn from you. And so I thought an interesting kind of contra institutional education question to ask at the outset of this dialogue would be, what are you learning? What are you learning? And what would it be like also to have a class in which you asked, what are you learning? Like, what, how does that shift the quality of education? And just briefly for me, I'll bring this piece in because it's been very alive for me this past week. I've experienced a lot of flux and change in my life recently in relation to living out here in Oaxaca on the frontier. And what I found is that there's a place in which I can come into a clarity in my heart in relation to Oaxaca, from which suddenly the landscape of opportunity, the landscape of possibility, the landscape of my myriad different projects becomes very, very available to me. And I'm kind of rightly coupled with that in a way that now it's like I have a kind of agency to learn and grow and to put myself into difficult situations, to do things that I'm afraid to do in order to bring about the kind of future that I want to bring about. And so what that speaks to for me is that there's something deeper underlying our educational sense making. And to a certain extent, if we can get right in our heart, if we can get right in our wisdom, if we can kind of find that place from which we're looking out from, then the landscape of what we can do, what we can learn, how we could collaborate with others becomes much more available. And it's really not at all clear to me that the educational paradigm we've inherited speaks to this at all. It's much more systematic and machine like. So with that, I want to open it up to you, fine gentlemen, and feel free also to bring through some of what we were speaking about before if it feels relevant.
Well, I'll just start to say a few. It's always a delight to see you fine people. And like we were starting before we started recording, like something that's just very interesting to me is this conflation, what seems between like focus, the ability to creatively focus on a project, and how in school, you're almost, and then in society and modernity at large, focus is actually associated with the ability to like thoughtlessness, to mechanically do something to its end. And both of these are kind of conflated with kind of focus, right? Like you're given instructions at work and you follow them, right? But this focus seems very different from the focus of, say, writing a novel or solving a problem, right? And yet, we tend to just kind of say, oh, if you're able to see something to its completion or do it for a long time, then that means you're focused and disciplined. Well, that there could be some conflations that are very problematic because I can do something for a long time simply by turning off my brain and doing it, right? And then the other thing we were saying is how very interesting, just based on Tim's point, on the idea that when you move from like math to PE to poetry, It's almost like focus is the ability to think about math for 30 minutes, then turn off your brain, think about English for 30 minutes, then turn off your brain. And focus is the ability to change subjects and return, like Tim was saying before, to a kind of tabula rasa, to a kind of emptiness. Like you're able to close your brain off. Focus means able to return to an empty space to receive, right? All of these kind of understandings of focus seem very problematic. They seem to be very problematic conflations. And also, I'll just note, you know, Ivan Illich talks about awareness. Simone Weil talks about attention. And Dr. McKilcrest talks about attention. And all of them are saying that attention is kind of the base level of thought. And if you don't know what attention is, what I would associate with focus, you're in huge, huge trouble. Like, let's take Dr. McKilcrest and the matter of things and all these different ideas. It's like he makes an example where he says, you know, 13 ways of looking at a blackbird, I guess Wallace Stevens, and, you know, you got things are physics, biology, emotions. There are a lot of different dimensions to a given phenomenon, right? And the point is that the way you pay attention to things transform how they come towards you, how you experience them, right? And you actually have to make a choice of how you're going to pay attention to things, because that's going to transform your awareness of the world around you. And for people like Simone Weil or Ivan Illich, this is at the very foundation of what it means to be human. Like if you're not able to think through your attention, how you give things attention, how you're able to focus, and you really can't be a human being. And so this kind of idea of, like we were talking about last time, on this kind of Neil Postman idea of what does the medium of the classroom teach you beyond just the subjects, there's something about the medium of the school system that suggests to you that focus is actually a thoughtlessness or a return to a blank, an openness to receive, of which then would moralize the inability to give attention to attention as needed in a Dr. McKilcrest or an Ivan Illich or a Simone Weil to be fully human. So I think the stakes here are very, very high, but I'll pass it on.
Yeah, and I think what you're describing, Daniel, connects to the question that Daniel asked us about, or that Jacob asked us about ritual when we first joined in, right? This pattern of clearing the mind to receive is a very important part of the daily ritual of schools, right? Whether it's the do nows that we talked about that now sort of dominate the way classrooms start in the United States and other parts of the world, whether it's the automatic response that you see in classrooms during a first period class, if announcements come on in the morning during first period and people stop everything that they were doing in the classroom to now empty their head and focus on whatever the announcements are, right? There is this ritualization that is about turning off attention, right? That is about turning off thinking through things and being in a position to receive information. Right, that I think is foundational to the modern education project, right, is that, you know, I go back to Kant's claim to be standing on the shoulders of giants, right, as a philosopher. And nobody would really make this connection directly, at least I don't think so. But right, once we take that attitude toward history, right, that we stand on the shoulders of giants, then the mission of school becomes primarily transmission, right? Like all these great things, great people happen before us. We as educators need to transmit that to you, while at the same time instantly forgetting that the giants that we're acknowledging need to be transmitted were giants because they transformed the conversation that was going on in the world around them at the time, right? Either with their actions, inventing something, or with their words as actions, right? Writing something to try to have an impact on the world around them, right? I've often found this tension to be a foundational one in the rituals of schooling, is that the systems are set up primarily for transmission, right? We know this, we need to pass this along with you. The stated goal is that if we transmit, students will become transformational. right? That they will have all this interesting information. They too will stand on the shoulders of giants, and therefore they will be able to do transformational work in a way that is very identified with the Enlightenment, right? The past is this. We're going to understand the past and then use that energy to produce a better future, right? But the rituals have become so dominant in not just our K-12 education systems, but even in our higher education systems, right, about this transmission of knowledge, that learners rarely get to pay attention to their lessons. And I'm using that language very specifically to connect to you, but also to think about what it would mean if learners actually paid attention rather than just received. And so therefore, they have no idea of the transformational work that would be possible because it's never allowed in the rituals of school. It's an assumption that once you've grown up and graduated, then you can do transformational work, right? Because you have all the right stuff. But if we go back and look at the kid who is thinking about algebra and French in the middle of PE, right? That kid is likely to do something more interesting and transformational in PE than the kid who is just following the directions of the coach, right? Because they're blending what they're thinking about. And I'll close, and I see Jacob's puzzlement here. I'll close by saying I think the distinction we need to talk about is the notion of focus that we're kicking around, this kind of emptiness to reception, versus the notion of focus that comes from Mikhail Csikszentmihalyi's work on flow, right? Where your attention is focused to the point that you're able to draw lots of stimuli in simultaneously. And this concept we tend to reserve only for those who are well trained, right? Like as people were reading Csikszentmihalyi in the 90s, and they're thinking about this person who's such an expert, they know so much that they can get into a flow state. What we forget is that the kids who come into our classrooms in early grades are in that flow state. They are completely attentive to the world around them. They miss nothing, right? Which is why they sometimes say the most outlandish things, because they see things that the rest of us who are focused don't see, right? And we literally train that out of them until such point that they become experts in the fields and can recapture the experience of flow. Right? Rather than allow them to go through their childhood with the attentiveness of a kind of flow state that they learn on their own. They come to school already aware of the world in that way. And I think there's some interesting questions that we can explore today about why we do that to kids.
Well, I'll just jump in. I really love what you just said right there about flow. And I think honestly, when you observe children, that's exactly right. And that should be taken seriously. And like Dr. Hammerwick will talk about, we need to think about our institutions from an anthropological base level. Like, what do you see children doing? Okay, they have this flow. How do we channel that, or how do we incubate that? Versus it's almost like what we do is we take it out of them, move them to a transfer knowledge and say, well, yeah, now get it back. Well, you took it out of me. I can't get it back. Like, where's it come from? And you moralize it away. I'm also thinking, like you were talking about tradition, it's almost like what we do is we hand people a base, like you're talking about, like, let's transfer, give them the tradition, and then they'll be transformative. It's almost like we give them a baseball and say, all right, throw it. It's like, well, I don't know how to throw it. Well, of course, that's a baseball. We think that if I just give it to you, that is the thing that will teach you how to do the act of throwing the ball. When really it seems like it's better to teach you how to throw the ball and then you go look for balls. You're like, oh, well, now that I know how to throw, now I'm going to go look for a ball. It's almost like, C.S. Lewis has a great idea where if you put first things first, you get second things also. But if you put second things first, you lose both. That's almost like what's going on. It's almost like we're giving the tradition, expecting that to lead to the transformation, when it's almost like you focus on channeling the transformation and then they go look to the tradition. I mean, I could say that personally. Like, there is nothing that makes me want to read history than writing a novel, like a creative work. Then I want to go read everything. But then when it was in the classroom of going and reading everything, I don't want to do this. I was sitting in the back working on the Sword Tribulation. I don't want to be here. But then once it was my own projects, that led me into wanting to learn the tradition and study different things. So I really agree with that. I think we get it backwards. The other thing I'm thinking about is it's really interesting on this kind of click. There's something about like clearing the mind that sounds like meditation, right? There's like clearing the mind, Buddhists clear your mind so that you can receive. But then there's also turn your mind off. And that seems to be really bad. And what's very interesting, it's as if all of these things that are so dangerous are a perverted form of a good thing. Like the ability to be like thoughtless, that's a perverted focus in a way, right? So like turning your mind off is a perverted meditation. So, you know, from like a Christian theology, all evils or sins are a misordered good, right? Like there's nothing wrong with sex, but there's something wrong with lust. There's nothing wrong with food, but there's something wrong with gluttony. And it's almost like the problem is, this is what I'm wondering. It's almost like the more you scale, the more and more the good thing is likely to become the bad form of it. So like focus, once you scale, is more likely to become mechanical thoughtlessness. You know, that once you take something like meditation, clear the mind to receive, and once you scale it, it tends to have a possibility of naturally formulating into the turning off, unless you're intentional. That's the problem. Like there's something about scaling that we then tend to become too mechanical in our thinking and lose sight of the details because you move to the big picture. And it's like we're facing the consequences of that because we haven't, I guess you could say, scale artfully or spread artfully or thinking about differences between scale and spread, numbers, you know, there's a lot there. The last thing I'll say is that it also would seem to me that if you cannot learn how to pay attention, well, we were saying last time, like, well, capital, making everything fungible, reducing everything to that, like to notice that occurring, you would need what? Attention, focus. Wait a minute, I'm reducing everything into fungibility. Well, you don't have focus. And you're like, well, let me clear my mind to understand the world, where if clearing your mind means turning it off, then in that state of meditation, you're not going to realize that everything has been turned into a commodity form or that you have absorbed brainwashing. So the perverted forms of all of these lead to the inability to see what's going on and thus to engage in transformation. We're just stuck in a transference. We receive. Well, then transference without transformation means you just receive the commodity form. You just receive the zeitgeist and you can't transform it. So it becomes a kind of self-fulfilling thing. So anyway.
But the zeitgeist holds a transformational, the zeitgeist can be ideological and transformational, and you can receive it and be a participant in transformation, but there's some subtle distinction there between transformation that is an enactment of that which is received and transformation which is transformational of that which is received also. And I think that's a really crucial difference to hold. And as I hear that, I'm reflecting back on what we explored in the first dialogue extensively about the kind of inseparable relationship between education and the marketplace and the working world and the form of the working world, which education is funneling us towards. And I'm thinking about how, it's possible that you could survive your attentional capacity, let's call it long attention or deep attention, could survive the educational system, or you could recover it, but you still might not. You still might find yourself on the outside in respect to how to bring that through and couple it with the world in a way that sustains you. But the alternative is almost certainly going to be that is something you're kind of preserving outside of and around the more short attention, non-thinking, focused, based tasks that are what you will get paid for the most part in today's economy. And I'm hesitant to throw this in because whenever we throw AI, it's just like somebody kicks the ball into another playground and the rules of the game completely changed, and it's hard to hold the continuity with that because it's kind of like a hyperspeed piece on this conversation, but it's you know, it's inescapable for us, so we can gently presence that now and hold that consideration of how can long attention find its place better in the world of AI.
So I, I think I'll tackle this question by asking, what is the subject in school? Right? The typical answer from those who are socialized to the experience of mass education, and Daniel, I think you're right to bring in scale. But I think I would put mechanization before scale rather than scale leads to mechanization, right? And then when you mechanize, then you realize efficiencies that start leading to questions of scale, right? But for me, the subject of school is not a particular set of lessons. It's not a curriculum, right? It's the actual students that are in the school who are the subjects of school, right? They're going through a process of subjectification. In learning to accept these rituals, in learning to accept the rapid refocusing of tasks, right? Like 1 minute you're doing one subject, the next minute you're doing another subject, right? In learning to accept proper ways of thinking, right? We're in the process of constituting modern subjects, right? Who can be governable. Foucault never wrote directly about schools. He wrote a lot about education, but never directly about schools in the way he wrote about the prison system or in the way he wrote about sexuality, right? But we are definitely in the process of producing a modern subject as we put people through education. And I think that gets to the issue of driving a certain amount of creativity out, because creativity implies a certain set of agency. Right. And there's a conflict in our language in schools around agency and subjectivity, right? Because we kind of drive the agency out to create this. I'm using the word subject. Our education dialogue would use the word citizen, right? To create this kind of citizen that we like, who will be an agent, but only in certain ways, right? They will vote, but they won't protest, right? They will invest, but they, until very recently, they may not likely innovate, right? Like they let others do some innovation. And I think this goes back to a really important question about a fundamental assumption at the root of modern education is that not everyone is going to be able to be an agent, either because of their financial circumstances, either because of their IQ limits, which we know is crap today, right? But like we still are heavily invested in that notion that people have different degrees of smartness or intelligence, right? And that the process of school is actually sorting the subjects from the agents, right? In a very, very long, sustained, drawn out way, so that kids have chances, right? It doesn't happen like first test you take in kindergarten, oh, you're going this route, right? But gradually over time, kids start getting filtered in one direction or another, not unlike the sorting hat in Harry Potter. Right. Although that happens right the first minute you show up at Hogwarts, right? It's sort of like, oh, you're going to this house, right? And I think in our education system, it's more drawn out because we know that, or we used to know that one simple test does not define a kid. I think that's in debate today. But this question of, again, I think the metaphorical metaphors or the mechanical metaphors are really important here, because we look at our schools as a machine that produces a modern subject, capable of agency on certain things that we permit, incapable of agency on other things, because those things make us nervous or because we don't expect them at scale. To go to Daniel's point, right? Like, you don't expect to get an Einstein out of every classroom, right? There's some sense that there are some unique individuals who do preserve the long attention, do escape the system, do get into positions where they're able to do certain things, right? But the reality is that even those individuals end up facing certain rituals of subjectification at the highest levels, right? There's this wonderful history called Who Got Einstein's Chair, which is a story of all the debates that happened after Einstein died at the Advanced Institute for Study, right? And what went on to determine who is going to get Einstein's chair at this, at the Institute after he died, right? And there was a whole lot of packing high-powered quantum theorists, really high, you know, super intellectual people, into modes of subjectivity that reinforce the culture of the Institute, right? Rather than saying, oh, well, here's clearly the next genius, we're going to give it to them, right? It was like, who's the genius that's going to fit in with the culture and structure of the Institute more, rather than who's clearly the brightest light, right? And the way in which people who by all measure have the ability to pay attention that we were talking about, right, fought with each other for that to demonstrate their institutional fidelity. It's a fascinating story. Right. So this notion that somewhere at the end, there is a place where you can have long attention and flow, right, is, I think, largely illusory. Right. The only place to do that is to detach from the systems altogether.
Magnificent. I'm going to have to read that book. And I think that's also really important, is where you say, oh, well, the system's going to lead you to a place of long attention and flow. It's a kind of myth that keeps you in going forward. It's like, no, there has to be some sort of detachment. You know, my friend Lorenzo does a lot of work on talking about game theory, and we'll have conferences about like neurodivergence and how you act. Like if you're in the neurotypical or the subjugate, the process of making the modern subject, you're not going to find that. You have to be neurodivergent. But of course, like one of the issues is neurodivergence is quite difficult in the sense that if you feel the rejection, that's the problem. Like a system also becomes emotional. Like you can't just leave the system and not feel it. Like there's an emotional thing that kind of gets in, a subconscious thing. You're letting your parents down. You're letting your potential down and all of these different things. And one of the funny things he talks about, Lorenzo, is how in game theory, the only way you escape a Nash equilibrium is to do something non-rational, you know, because if everyone's doing what's rational, well, it's really easy for, it's much easier for someone who has like Asperger's or something, because they just like, yeah, this is the right thing to do. And they do it and they don't feel the rejection so much, right? And he's talking about how actually you need to introduce into collective consciousness neurodivergence, or otherwise the collective consciousness, everyone assumes, oh, if like the market of crowds and different things will give us the best result. He's like, maybe not if you don't have neurodivergency in there. So it's supposed to be a kind of expanding a diversity initiative to the neurodivergent, not just the neurotypical, because otherwise everyone could just be the subjugated forms that just reinforce the mechanization, whereas neurodivergency can actually be a source of true agency. Because the other problem is often we'll actually define the agent as someone who's just the best at the system of mechanization, where the one who has like the most power and money, it's like, that's an agent. It's like, maybe not. Maybe the person that's the agent is the one who can detach, right? But then it defines on what you are told is successful. So I really like, he did a wonderful TED talk on game theory and neurodivergence. I love Lorenzo. And it was just thinking about that. I think it's also wise to connect mechanization and scale. I don't think something can scale that isn't mechanical. It has to have this ability to work regardless the particularity over the particularity. It has to have a mechanical function. And you almost could say the problem with the problem, if we use that language, is we don't know how to make a really large garden. Like, how do you make a really large garden? We know how to make a really large robot or AI, but what would it mean to make a really big garden? We don't know. That's really hard. And basically, if you're talking about a movement of more agents than subjects, it would look like scaling a garden, not a machine. But wait a minute, the word scale by definition has always been mechanical. And for me, that kind of metaphorically frames the issue. And that I think gets into things like attention. The other thing I was going to say, I think it's very much the case, I guess Michael Sandel wrote about this as well, where the system of school is a kind of justification for where you end up. Like that's like the main function, is to kind of justify the class difference. And it's like, oh, you ended up well, you took the test, you must have worked the hardest. Meritocracy is more like a justification model, not necessarily a true. Well, you could make the argument, honestly, Like you probably this would be a larger like you probably can't have an actual meritocracy without radical transparency. Like in the sense of everyone is able to make not a resume but a portfolio, and then everyone has the attention to identify what is valuable in the portfolio, not just the values of the system, right? And by transparency, I mean the ability of something like Zoom, like the internet we were talking last time, where you could see, okay, this guy got an F minus on all of his tests, but look at him talk. I can see his portfolio, right? Like I worked as a photographer for 8 years, and you didn't give people your resume as a photographer, you gave them your portfolio, right? And I'm wondering, and I know I'm going to be talking Mr. Bowens and Voicecraft. It's some of the blockchain stuff, not the Bitcoin, but the blockchain on transparency ledgers and different things. There's a lot there that I think is quite interesting to take out the middleman. Like that would be the big thing where you could actually have just kind of show the work in a community, a commons and different things. But there's something about the need, like the school system that turns the majority into subjects is also based on resume creation, not portfolio creation, of which is in turn because a portfolio would be creative, right? Like you'd have to create your
Yeah,
portfolio.
not necessarily, right? I've watched and worked on portfolio systems in schools for almost 30 years now, and I've watched them become standardized, right? And mechanized. Like your portfolio needs to include these things and these things. Like we're seeing a lot of schools around the country now take on this question of developing a profile of the graduate, right? Which is designed to build a rounder, more liberal human being, not in the political sense, but just in the independence and freedom sense. But they end up being more checklists, right? Because that's what the system understands. So then the ability of the student to actually create their portfolio in the way you're talking about an artist or a photographer doing so, becomes problematic, right? And Daniel, or not Daniel, Jacob brought up AI earlier, and I think I want to talk about AI in this context as another form of subjectification, where we're all being taught that the highest form of thinking is the work of a sophomore college student, right? Because that's sort of the way AI writes. It writes like a college sophomore. It's not bad, right? But it's often wrong. It often plagiarizes, right? At least in its current iteration. It maybe get better, but it's training a whole generation of people to accept that as the most effective, the most efficient form of communication, right? So as a good example, like unless I'm doing stuff specifically for business where I'm communicating with business people, I ignore everything Grammarly tells me to do. Right. Now that Grammarly is deeply embedded in a lot of our apps, right? It'll start saying, oh, this is wrong and that is wrong. And I'm like, I don't care. Person at the other end will be able to read it, right? Whether it's all grammatically correct or not. And I think we're seeing the power of AI is not so much that it makes things easier. Right, because I can instantly generate the email that I need or a short speech that I need or whatever, right? It's that it convinces us that it's easier to do the things we need to do than it might be, right? And I'm thinking of Voltaire's famous quip about sorry for the long letter, I didn't have time to write a short one, right? I don't have time to really write a good speech. So I'm just going to hit AI and get this short thing that comes out, but it's not going to be very good, right? Who was it? I think it was Helen Mirren at the Screen Actors Guild Awards actually read an acceptance speech that was written by AI at when she got her award, right? I think just recently this I'm trying to, it was I think it was her. And then she told everybody, this is AI. See what kind of crap this is? I'll gladly pay for good writers, right? But I think that's that's a tension that we're wrestling with here, that goes back to like literally a tradition in schooling that goes all the way back to the Romans, who used to teach their kids to write by giving them those tracing things to write in, right? So they would learn to write their letters, right? Because it was easier to just say, put your pen in here and make this shape and trace it out, right? Than it was to actually teach them handwriting. So they just learned by rote tracing how to make the letters they needed to. And we have this notion that, again, it goes to scale, Daniel. Easier is not necessarily easy. It's what's most efficient, right? And I think there's a difference between easy and efficient. Sometimes for a truly creative person, it's easy to let the pen flow, right? As you're writing something, right? You can really very easily be taken up by a moment that you're paying attention to and write a really nice poem or write a really wonderful letter, right? That can be easy. But it may not be as efficient to reproduce at scale, right? So we have to have these tracing structures. And I just see AI as a new tracing structure that is going to teach a whole generation of people that you can't think that this, you can't write this, so let AI do it for you, or you can't create this picture, right? It's not going to be very efficient for you to do it. It could take you weeks if you want to make this picture, but if you just type in a few words, AI will create it for you right away. And that'll be a much more efficient use of your time. Rather, my wife said last night, I was talking about my master's thesis advisor who died in December. And I didn't know this about him. But when he was working on key texts that he really wanted to understand, he rewrote them in longhand. Like he literally spent the last 30 years of his life working on Gibbon's Decline and Fall. And to really understand Gibbon, he rewrote Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire in his own hand so he could get into Gibbon's way of thinking, right? That's really impressive. It's totally inefficient. And my wife's comment was, no university would pay an academic to rewrite a book by hand today, right? That's just way too inefficient. We can't waste time like that, right? So I think we've made this conflation between easy and efficient, right? And our entire system is about efficiency, rather than a notion of easiness that we might call gracefulness, right? That ability to, when you think of romantic poets of the 19th century, you get this image of somebody like sitting on a grassy hill in the countryside and staring at the naturescape and going like, I see it all and writing it down, right? That there was a kind of inspiration or genius that happened. We're not interested in that at all anymore. We just want efficient outcomes. And AI is going to train a generation of people to be efficient rather than to be inspired.
Two things that come up for me in that, Tim. The first is the sense of flexibility that I as a creative require and am always wrestling with, and that the ebb and flow of creative impulse is not something that I can schedule. And sometimes I'll feel a creative energy is here, but I've put in my schedule, I'm going to, do my menial work tasks during this time. And I had this just the other day. I had all this creative juice coming, but it was the time for me to finish that work. And, I want to keep my house in order. So I stuck with doing the work. And by the time I had finished the menial work, that creative energy had gone away. And it took much of the rest of the day to reconnect with it. And it's not something you can kind of just bring back in. Once you've kind of, once you've rendered your creative energy into that short-term focus energy, it can just be gone. And so there's something around the structuring of days and a balance that I'm constantly trying to find as someone who does have quite a bit of flexibility. Like the working day, 9 to 5, show up in these hours. What if your creative impulse comes during those hours? What if one person's creative impulse comes in the pre-dawn hours, another person's comes late at night, so on and so forth? There's a deep particularity to that has to be recognized. And I don't know how you organize collectively in a way that is in tune with that. But that seems to be kind of the task that is ahead of the wisdom commons and of creative collectives, is to be able to find a way for individuals to be in attunement with their own creative movement, and also to be sufficiently responsible, response able, responsive, and consistent in quality to couple and be a piece of a larger garden, a larger flourishing. And so alongside that flexibility, there's also a question of patience, which really illustrated in your story. It might take somebody a really, really long time to glean an insight. And it might take a very special kind of employer or patron or educational institution to actually recognize, oh, this person is not engaged in a 1 to 2 year yielding project. This person is engaged in a 1 to 30 year yielding project. And that's a very different attitude. And it connects with my sense that I spoke to in the first dialogue of life as the educational project, life as the primary ground of education rather than educational institutions, because significant pieces of the understanding that constitute perhaps your greatest project or your greatest contribution or the insight that you contribute to the world can come from life experiences where it's not necessarily obvious and it's not necessarily easily placed into that kind of tick box resume that so many students now have if they want to go to Harvard or another institution. So those are two pieces that I think have to be really felt through for this kind of liminal education space.
Excellent. So a few things. First, on the question of, I think what AI may train us into is to associate like focus as intelligence and being capable of the best inputs, like who can come up with the best inputs, not thinking through something. So that's very mechanical and problematic. That was a question that was asked. I think also on the question of like, what am I learning in school? I think like at the base, what you're learning is a certain kind of motivation and a kind of ethic of what makes you an adult or a productive person. Like I like, you asked that at the beginning, and I just wanted to say that question would be as a kind of meta question on, no, not what you're learning in terms of the information, but what you're learning about what it means to live a productive, disciplined, successful life. Like what are the rituals that school is teaching you? That would probably be quite a revelatory experience. And then likewise to ask them, hey, in using AI, what are you learning is intelligent based on the use of AI? That perhaps one of the problems is school doesn't have enough of those kind of assessments. You know, you go to the boss every 6 months, 6 months assessment. Maybe you need more of these kind of meta assessments from the students themselves that are not asking them about the information, but about the medium. That might be quite eye-opening and interesting. I was going to say a few things. Tim made a very good point about the portfolio can just become mechanical as well. So this is the issue for me. And this is why I think like something like a focus or attention is actually very fundamental, like base. So the other thing is if you lose attention or focus, you also can't tell that the school system is turning in you into a subject because you're not paying attention to the mechanism that is subjugating you. And so there's something about removing attention that is necessary for the process of subjugation to get away Absolutely. With it, right?
Yep.
And mm-hmm. so one of the problems is, though, there's a lot of talk of increasing transparency, but here's the problem. If you don't have focus and attention and I show you everything, then you may actually just use it for surveillance, because what you'll see is people's portfolio is creative. Well, that's not what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to be mechanical. And so transparency actually leads to people oppressing one another back into the structure. And see, this mm-hmm. is the, and then actually transparent, because here's the issue. It seems like you need transparency in order to not rely on systems of authority and stamping of approval. But if you get that transparency and you don't have the ability to focus on what matters or to evaluate outside of the system, then you may actually, as an individual, be part of preserving the system by seeing something that doesn't align with the values you've absorbed. And so you push the creativity back into mechanization. This is why, like, how does transparency not turn into surveillance? How does transparency not turn into oppression? It requires attention. It requires then, or focus, or the ability of people to actually identify what matters. So, you know, because you're asking questions too on kind of how can the energy particularization, I think a lot of people have said working as home is great because then some people are productive at night, early in the morning. The other thing I will say that working at home is advantageous is like with kids, you just need 15 minutes here, 10 minutes here, 5 minutes there, and you can actually get that. And it's actually funny enough, there's an increase in efficiency. Whereas at other places, you may be standing at the counter waiting for a customer for 30 minutes and nobody is there. Like there's something to be said about a kind of radical inefficiency to a lot of how work is done because you don't know when the demand is going to show up at the store, right? So you have to be there always. Well, there would have like theoretically been 10 minutes in there when you weren't doing anything where you could have read that book or gone and taking care of your kids, but you're not allowed to do that because that's seen as not being part of the job and you're wasting time and so on and so forth, right? So there's actually a problem of a kind of information of time use that you could say the system has that leads to this mechanization, that leads to just people being in a space, wasting 20 minutes here because they actually, no one's at Walmart or whatever, or no one's at Starbucks, but they have to be there because you don't know when the demand is going to show up. So you just have to be there all the time, right? And so that then leads, that's very anti the creative flow, right? Because while you're standing at that counter at Starbucks, you may suddenly have the creativity to write a poem, but you're not allowed to because you're at work, right? So the question is, what would it look like to have so this is the other thing. Given the amount of wasted time that actually occurs at work, it is not necessarily the case that figuring out mechanisms to allow more creativity that would drop productivity, because that's what a lot of people think, right? Like if you were to actually open up avenues of creativity, productivity would go down. Not necessarily, because there's a lot of time waste. There's a lot of inefficiency of productivity based on not knowing when the demand shows up, right? So working at home is an example of what could actually help with this relative to energies and different things. Because I can definitely tell you, there are plenty of times where creativity shows up. I write the paper and then go back later and do the task that I was going to do. But if you're working, say, 2 to 5, you have to do that task within 2 to 5. You couldn't pick it up at 6, right? Whereas working at home, you could do that, right? So there's something about decentralization of the work schedule or the work life that could contribute to this problem. But here's the issue with that, though. If people aren't forced to go to work, they must be intentional about socializing. Because for most people, their socializing is being forced to go to work and interact with people or something like that, right? So there's a trade-off here where the more and more you give people freedom over their own schedules, the more and more they have to will and force themselves to relate with people, when I'm afraid to say that it's very natural for people to withdraw from others because of the difficulty and complexity of others, except people like them. Oh no, now we're in the tribal thing, right? And we're starting to kill pluralism and things like that. The last thing I'll say is it does say, I'm no expert on it. It is possible that blockchain technology helps with this problem because what it can do is create a ledger system. Now I'm not talking Bitcoin, that's a different ballgame. Right. I'm talking the blockchain that allows people to work on their own schedule, on their own time, that is not edible. You can't manipulate it. It's like transparent and you can see what people are doing. And then, yeah, they were working on their farm between 2 and 3, but who cares? I can see they did the work at some time that needed to be done, part of the community. Therefore, they get the productivity. You need a more sophisticated system of transparency for what people are doing that is reliable. But here's the problem, though. That would be my warning against kind of the blockchain stuff. That's a mechanism of transparency that doesn't necessarily guarantee that people have the attention to identify what is a good use of that transparency. Because the portfolio to me is better than the resume, because the resume, it's less like a portfolio. If the person is being mechanical, like when you open a portfolio where the pictures are clearly what the guy is doing, just because they've seen it online, they think it's like obvious that it's, you know, it's just catering to the audience. It's more transparent, right? But you have to have the attention as an artist to be able to tell the difference between a lame photograph that's just trying to make the customer happy versus a real work of creative artistic genius, right? You, as looking at the portfolio, have to see that. I think it's easier to hide mechanization on a resume because you're just filling in the void. You can't put your own creative spirit there, but it's not guaranteed on a portfolio. Even though that can help us, there is the question of the attention. And this is why the question of how do you train that attention Becomes a really big deal because we can give people all the transparency they want. We can give them the blockchain. We can give them an uneditable system. But if people don't know what they should look for or what exactly is garden versus machine, that's going to lead into various troubles. There's more to say, but I'll stop there.
Yeah, this question of transparency, I think, is very interesting. In exploring issues of education, and I like the way you said it, Daniel, that there's a certain degree of transparency that is almost a smoke and mirrors game that allows people to stay in the system, right? Like, look at this, I'm showing you all this information. And what I want to do is make a move here that I think is antithetical to the modern project. About this question of system, right? Because I think what we are transparent about increasingly is the system itself, not the individuals that are inside it, right? So we're telling you, it's like the opposite of the Matrix. Instead of lying in one of those little pods and not knowing that you're in a pod, right? We're telling you, like, here's all this information about the system that you're a part of, right? And we get that from Marxist historical analysis. We get that from systems thinking in the 1960s and 70s, right? And so there was a time prior to all these systems where education happened in the way that Jacob is talking about, right? Again, it was most people didn't receive education, but those who did, it was sort of like when the moment was opportune. We use the phrase teachable moment in school now, and that's all education was up until the reforms in the French revolutionary system in the late 1700s, right, where they tried to make education accessible to the masses and therefore started to experiment with systemization and systems. And you get Rousseau messing around with that a little bit in some of his writings. But I want to go to the practice of storytelling, which I think we as Europeans have totally missed the boat on, right? We think remembering the story is what's important, right? And like, you know, those horrible quizzes you had to take in high school English where you weren't asked what you thought about the book at all. You were just asked like, so, you know, what did Heathcliff say on page 942 of Wuthering Heights or whatever, right? And it's like, who the hell cares, right? But it's like the emphasis of everything, whether it's in a history class, whether it's in literature, right? The emphasis is in Western culture is that you remember the story. The assumption is that it's important to remember the story because there's some lesson in there, right? And if we go all the way back to something like Aesop's Fables, right, you get this very literal, like, and the moral of the story is so that it doesn't get missed, right? So like, you're going to learn the story, you need to know key parts in the story in order to be able to understand what the moral of the story is. Outside of Western culture, there seems to be a completely different attitude towards storytelling, which is not that I'm going to tell you a story and then you're going to recite it back to me that you know, to show me that you know it. But it's, I'm going to tell you a story, right? Grandmother, wise elder, whatever, is going to tell this story. And then I'm going to sit back like this and wait to see how you respond to it. Because I'm trying to learn something about you. And this goes back to something that I think Jacob mentioned at the beginning, right? Is when are school spaces that we're trying to learn about kids, right? Almost never. Right? Unless we're gathering data on what they know, have they internalized what that has been delivered to them, right? But we rarely do we have kids read a story and then step back and listen to what they have to say about it. Rarely do we have them conduct an experiment and not judge them for whether they conducted the experiment correctly, but rather ask them, what do you think you can conclude from this experiment, right? And in a lot of pre-modern cultures, this was about learning something about the kids. It had a sorting function altogether as well, but it was about learning those kids that needed to be doing certain things because of the way they tended to respond to the stories. And there was a wisdom in that society that said, you know, when a kid responds to this story that way, it probably means they're more likely to be good at this task that society functions, right? And when a kid responds to this story in that way, you know, as Cicero said in one of his writings, you know, kill them because they're going to be a problem. Right? So if your kid responds to a story this way, just go ahead and kill him right now because they're going to grow up to be a real problem, right? And that seems harsh to us, but it was the result of a lot of storytelling where people knew the kind of responses that people would have and the kind of people those folks grew up to, right? And that was about empowering learners to be the subjects of their own story, right? But also a social check on that said, you know, you're welcome to make this choice if you want, right? But there may be some consequences for making this choice. And I think about this in the context of contemporary politics today, right? There's a whole lot of people who, when they read or receive the story of the Holocaust now, seem to be making a choice. Well, that was a pretty darn good thing. And we should have more people like that who get rid of the impure elements in society, right? those are not people we really want around, right? To a certain extent. Now, I'm not arguing that we eliminate them either, but if that's the response of a group of people to the Holocaust, right? We need to be thinking about how we're going to do something as a society to change the way that's received, right? As opposed to people who hear the story of the Holocaust and say, oh, that's horrible, and how could people do that, and we should never allow that to happen again, right? And the question isn't whether people remember the statistics or the details of the Holocaust. It's sort of what their response is to it, right? And whether that's in alignment. And I'll just close with this fun anecdote from ancient Spartan society, right? Part of their educational process, at least for young men who are likely to be in the elite, right? There was an expectation that as you entered your early teens, you would at some point go to steal cheese from the temple. Right? If you did not steal cheese from the temple, you would not make the cut and be relegated to insignificant roles in Spartan society. If you did steal the cheese from this temple, you would be beaten senseless with rods by the priests. Right? So there was this kind of this, like, it's up to you what choice you're going to make here, right? But if you make this choice, you're not going to be moved along any further. And if you make this choice over here, you're going to pay the consequence that anybody who steals things from the temple should pay, right? But you're also going to get to be advanced along in terms of your role in the leadership of our society, because you understand that sometimes you need to break the rules, pay the consequences for breaking the rules in order to protect society, right? So this question of, like, we don't let kids make their own decisions anymore, anywhere in our system of education, right? I'll go back to your language of, if they follow the instructions, they get rewarded, right? And there's a difference, I think, between accepting that your lot in society is to follow the instructions and accepting that your lot in society is occasionally doing things that violate social norms but may require consequences for them, but don't immediately get you kicked out, right? And if you don't accept the norms of school, you're going to get marginalized very, very quickly in our society.
Yeah. I just feel I feel the color shift in the conversation as soon as you introduce that storytelling notion, and it brings me into a completely different space of what education can be and what education can feel like. And I'm thinking about the Lord of the Rings because I've been thinking about it for this upcoming conversation, and as I revisit that, first noting, okay, this, like, the stories that really compelled me were occurring outside of schooling, no doubt. It was things like The Lord of the Rings, Band of Brothers, the miniseries and book. These things I was drawn to again and again and again and again. And I wasn't consciously involved in an educational process. I was engaging with a profoundly compelling mythical world. But as I revisit those things as an adult and I look at them and I actually try and peel back the layers, I find, okay, this is so densely interwoven with values and context and symbolism. Like it's an educational hyper object. Once you kind of peel it back and look at what's actually going on. And so just wanted to presence that piece, because it inspires me, and it's like, it's also a sense that a space of education that allowed me to delve. Like, I had this one experimental year in seventh grade where the school did an experimental curriculum. And instead of that kind of like math, science, PE, French model that we talked about, we had it kind of organized around themes. And they really did like, we had like an E equals MC squared theme, and we talked about science and we talked about weather. And then we had like a medieval theme, and we got to like build something practical. We built a trebuchet, you know, we delved into particular parts of history, parts of science, and it was all kind of like clustering around thematic interest. And then also like creating a collected artifact out of that. And I just remember it being so compelling and so exciting. And then after that year, I got sent straight back into the next school, and it was right back into the regular wheelhouse, and it was just a blip. But I pray for more of that, because it was so enriching. And the other piece that I notice being in Mexico is that the nature of the workplace is more decentralized. It's less uniform. You don't really have so much of that uniformity of values that a Starbucks has. And so if somebody's running their coffee shop, they kind of run it how they want to run it. And if they're going to be sitting on a couch working on their sketches for the day until a client comes in, and then, you know, get up, make them the drink, and go back to what they were doing, or indeed a lot of people having children in their workplace, and the division between doing the work and tending to the family, educating the children, is much more fluid. And work itself is something like, partly, of course, through necessity, but there's a lot of 12-year-old, 13-year-old boys out here that have jobs some days of the week, especially if you go to the villages and the pueblos. You know, the 12-year-olds are acting as tour guides, or they're driving your tuk-tuk around for you, and so on and so forth. And I think this gives the kind of esteem of participation, which I personally feel like I really, really lacked, because of, you know, only going to school and then going home and playing video games, and not really having that, like, we're going out into the woods to build something, or here's, you know, you need to go and work on this thing for your grandfather and spend part of your time working in his craft shop or something like that. Oh, Tim, you're on mute.
Yeah, I know you're itching, but I just want to say one thing about the Lord of the Rings example that you brought up, because I think it's important, right? In modern Western thinking, we spend a lot of time trying to understand what Tolkien was saying to us as readers, right? That would lead us to the conclusion that we should destroy the ring, right? In most other cultures, all you need to know is if your kid acts like Boromir, you've got a problem, right? If your kid acts like Frodo, life's good, right? So if your kid hears the story of the Lord of the Ring and says, well, daddy, why didn't they keep the ring and use it, right? Like, that's what you need to know. you don't need to know why a kid would make that decision. All you really need to know is, so we're so busy trying to replicate certain types of subjects, right? Like, we want to find a way to understand what are the moves that Tolkien makes in his books that produces somebody who says, destroy the ring, right? Pre-modern societies were just sort of like, All we need to know is who the people are who want to destroy the ring. They're the good people. We'll move them forward, right? And part of that is just simply a question of scale, right? As societies grew and expanded in size, 100 to 150 years ago, most large communities had prisons that held 20 or 30 people, right? There just weren't that many bad people. And that has increased dramatically with the increase in population in the last 150 years. So I just want to drop that in that, like, we can spend a lot of time trying to systematize what Tolkien was doing that would convince us not to use the ring, right? But in a pre-modern education environment or an indigenous education environment, I tell the story, I watch which kids want to save the ring and which kids don't, and I stop working with the kids who want to save the ring, right? Because they're not going to be good for my community. I find some place to put them, right? I don't
And
ask
also, like,
decision. It's just like it, yeah, but
there's this multi-layered sense of, like, the Lord of the Rings is a story, but the characters within the Lord of the Rings also recognize themselves to be within a story. And there's that self-referentiality of living in story. And you get these moments where, they're going through hardship, and Sam is like, oh yeah, we're like the heroes in the stories. And they're constantly in relationship to the lore and to the mythos of what came before. Everybody's contending with the myth, whether it's, good or bad, for Boromir, for Théoden and Rohan, even for Aragorn. A lot of them have these stories of a kind of fallenness, and, like, the former glory and a sense of, like, can I be the restorer of this? And you just don't see that, like, brought into most people's lives. Like, where is that sense of, like, I'm part of a greater story, and I can actually in my lifetime be a redeemer or a fulfiller of a story that lives beyond me and goes to my ancestral line, and so on and so forth.
makes me think of a wonderful line in Locke's treatises on the state of nature. And when man trades his nuts for a piece of metal, nature has ended. A good friend of mine wrote a dissertation about castration anxiety and Locke related to that, right? But this idea that, like, as soon as you make it about the money, right, then this sense of being part of a story becomes irrelevant. As soon as you make the goal, the accumulation of wealth, commodification, money, right? Being part of a story is meaningless. Who cares if you're a hero, right? Heroes end up dead. Who cares if you're wise? The wise end up poor, right? Like, so it goes back to what we were talking about in the last time we met around the stress of making all of this about acquiring money and producing money, right? Producing wealth. So I've said a lot. Daniel, jump in.
No, it's all outstanding. So wonderful. A few things come to mind. I was going to note as well, like you were saying, that we don't let kids make choices today. Well, if we remove focus, then they tend not to be able to make good choices. So then when they make bad choices, we say, well, that's why we don't give them choices. And it all becomes part of kind of a mechanism of, because in order, in my, like, in order, one of the, I think, keys for power or systems, however we want to put it, to maintain itself, is that it allows enough space for rebellion against it that fails. Like, or something like, it's a kind of like false flag or something like that, right? So it's like, yeah, we gave kids attention. They just look at their cell phones. You really want to give them choice or different things or different things? Yeah, well, they're doing that because they've been taught that focus is moving, like literally focus is turning off brain, start new subject, turning off. Like the curriculum of school is attention deficit disorder. And of course they have attention deficit disorder. That's the joke. They're like, all these kids have attention deficit disorder. They can't learn. Yes, because that's the curriculum. The curriculum is to freaking be deficit in your intention for English for 30 minutes, only 30 minutes, and then it's over. Anyway. So a bunch of things on what you're saying, I really like that, really crystallizes a lot for me, Tim, on the idea of telling a story and the response to it. That's really lovely. So it's very interesting because, as well with that, and we're talking about the why and the mechanical and how you make money, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's interesting how like religions are at their best when every Sunday they're telling a parable. Parable, story, story, story. And how do you respond? They don't sit up there. They like very often, yeah, the preacher will say, you know, what this may mean, but it's very, very open. It's more like, how do you respond to Jesus, you know, the prodigal son? How do you respond to these different stories? And what's very interesting as well is these stories tend to be told over and over and over and over again, which allows the education to be the change in the response or the kind of transformation of the response. And you get to revisit it and revisit it. And then also critically, you're kind of taught that the fullness of a thing comes with time ripening and experience versus in a mechanical mindset. Oh no, the fullness is there. Just find how much it's worth. Anyone of any age can do it, right? It makes me think of like Aristotle talking about, it's very interesting. He says there are plenty of mathematical prodigies who are young, but there really are not like philosophy or wisdom prodigies, right? Because there's something about like, or in the arts, like these kind of like this stuff, like philosophy prodigy. What he's pointing at, Aristotle's getting at, is that wisdom in the highest sense must be experiential. But by experience, this is key. By experience, he means the realization that a thing can unfold through time in ever new ways in your response to it. It's more like a garden, right? But you see, the way we teach, like you're saying with money, is like the why. It's a mechanical thing. Like, what is the why behind it? You're actually trying to dissect it. Most thinking, like modern thinking, is fundamentally deconstructive. It's about getting to what does the story mean? No, not how you, no, how do you respond to the story? No, I want to get to the secret in it. Well, that means you have to destroy it. It's a surgery. And so then we wonder why there's a nihilism and meaning crisis. Yeah, because all thinking is surgery. So you kill everything to get to a meaning that's not there because the meaning was the story. It makes me think of I think Flannery O'Connor, she was at a writing conference. No, it's like she was at Iowa or something. Somebody asked her, you know, what was the meaning of the misfit's hat in the story? And she was like, what was it as a symbol? And she's like, to be on his head. And everyone laughed at her, like, no, my gosh, she didn't have any intention. She's like, this is, she was basically like, this is the end of literature because people go into story symbol hunting. They go meaning hunting. And Walker Percy had a great line where he said something like, a novel is an emotion that could go by no other words. And so the whole novel is the emotion. If you break it down, the emotion's gone. But we are literally led to have the Ricœur, you know, Paul Ricœur, you know, hermeneutics of suspicion, where you go in and say, what does that hat mean on the misfit's hat, right? What does it mean? And what Flannery O'Connor emphasizes is he says, we've replaced sacrament with symbol and lost both. Like a sacrament is something you respond to, a symbol is something you find. And she's like, nature is not a collection of symbols. Nature for her as a Catholic is a collection of sacraments that you respond to. And there's something about it in a story for her is sacramental. You respond to it. So in a way, modern education is about symbol hunting, finding the money in the thing, not the experience of it. It's about the mechanic, like the question why. I was talking with Matthew Allison. Let me put it this way. Very often we think thinking is a question of why, like how to, like finding the why in things, which is deconstructive. When really real thinking seems to be knowing how to live your life in a manner so you encounter something where instead you don't say why, you say how in like all. How is this happening? I think about all throughout the Bible with the characters like, how will I birth the Messiah? How will I, like, how, not in a kind of pragmatist, it's kind of a redeemed pragmatism, but like a how is this happening kind of an all sort of thing, right? And likewise, a good story makes you go, it has a like, kind of what's going to happen in the response to it. And critically in Aristotle, and I think this gets to your point on you can tell somebody's character by how they respond to a story. Like if you are encountering a great story and you're not going, oh, then that's on you. That's a deficiency on you. If you don't like, you know, often we say it's taste, right? Like, oh, everyone has a different opinion. Well, this is part of the problem. Like you were making the Holocaust example. We've literally put like how people respond outside of education. Well, that's opinion, that's difference, that's taste in different things. Aristotle would be like, if you literally think the Holocaust was like good, that's a deficiency on you. It's not an opinion for frick's sake. Like that's also where someone like Plato is saying, if you don't appreciate beauty, that's on you, not on beauty. Be very careful before you treat beauty as a thing of taste, because what they're all warning about, just the classical mind is like, if we say the stories and response is all taste and relative and all that, we're in trouble. Because here's the key. The response becomes the means of commonality. If you don't have that, you have to have a system. What else can bind people together? You know, if you don't have the commonality of response to the story that is the social mechanism, well, then all you have is something more mechanical, which then alienates and leads to all these other pathologies and different things. And then, like, to close the point, you also, it makes me think of the great Andrew Luber working with Alex, and they talk about how basically the Western mind doesn't even know what a story is because we don't know what theme is. And like, the correct way to go into a story is letting the story as a whole divulge to it the theme that then you respond to, not finding the symbol. And then, and it's like, you know, it makes me think of like a, cause someone like a Heidegger or a Blondel, where we treat philosophy like finding the why, when really it's learning how to let being disclose itself to itself on its own terms, right? Well, that's what they're doing with a story. Let me tell you a story and then you respond to it, right? And that's also kind of like a garden. Like we were saying, the garden thing. When you walk into a garden, the garden's kind of seeing how you respond to it in a way. How do you respond to a garden? Do you go in and say, why is this flower here? Why is this growing? It's very deconstructive. There's a role for why questions. But if the why never gets to the how did this grow? How is this here? You know, this kind of response to it, then there's a problem. Because, and then the key point from Aristotle, your response to the garden is on you. It's not a matter of taste. If you don't find the garden beautiful, there's a deficiency in you. And then also, I just think about the sharing of testimonies. I was talking with Andrew. I think like democracy, where we share stories. I think about like in Lord of the Rings, I say Son of Bramir from Rivendell. They give the story, the background. There's a telling of stories. Like, mm-hmm. I think that returning to the telling of stories in terms of people responding to it basically is what democracy is supposed to be. Without that, then it's your, what's your opinion? Oh, that opinion is wrong. It's very much a why and mechanical, as opposed to a sharing of, but then people have to know how to tell stories. People have to be able to kind of do that. And democracy being the collection of how people respond to stories, Christianity, testimonies. There's something here that is very, very important. And I think it's hard to have human beings without story as well. So if we don't know how to share stories and we don't know how to respond to stories, we're probably going to be more like artificial intelligences than human.
Yeah. I think you nicely summarize the tension that's at the heart of the modern educational system. Is we no longer share, at least in the West, but we no longer share a common aesthetic, a common taste. I would argue you're not wrong that when we don't, we're in trouble. But we also know that fundamentally there is no taste outside of a cultural envelope, right? Aristotle's notion of what would be beautiful and acceptable is different than ours, and there's no denying that, right? But when the modern world fragmented in the or when the world started to fragment in the 14, 15, and 1600s, right, and a system of values, at least in Western culture, couldn't hold itself together, then I think you're right. We tried to chain everybody to systems, right? And I think whether we want to call it postmodern or the end of the modern project, right, or metamodern or whatever, right, I think there's this realization that you can't ultimately mechanically create that was lost,
right?
Like, yeah, maybe we, there was a time when we were all Catholic in the West, right? There was nothing other than that. That got lost through the Protestant Reformation, the wars of religion, et cetera, in a way that was profoundly impactful on the minds of political thinkers in the West, right? Like, how do we recreate that consensus again? We've had a million social compact theories about how to do that, how we're going to mechanically recreate that. We've tried to build education systems on the foundation of those social contract theories about how to mechanically create that. And it turns out that you can't. Right? Because there are consequences that come from that. It doesn't mean that our plight is solved, right? I mean, it is still the case that we are unlikely to find a common humanity in any particular set of stories, right? In the way that was possible in the pre-rational age. But I But I wonder, and I'm going to need to get going here pretty soon because I got some other responsibilities I need to tag on. But I wonder if, to a certain extent, it isn't embracing that childlike, not childish, ability to soak in everything in the world, and a kind of a trust, or Jacob, I'll know you like it if I use the word faith, that if people are actually paying attention, they will see, right? I think of the line in scripture all the time, let him who has ears hear, right? Like, if you hear this, like, we'll get it. So I really appreciate the way you captured that break in your discussions and the challenges that it leaves us with. And I think what many of us are feeling is a desire for a return to some sort of story that we all respond to. Much in the way that a kid who finds out that, Saint Nicholas isn't real has that regret, right? But the fact that Saint Nicholas isn't real isn't going to go away. Right? Like, the fact that Saint Nicholas was your father or your mom or your grandfather or somebody who did those things for you, right? Like, that's not going to go away. The question is whether there's still value in the story, even if it's not true. And I think that's the real challenge, is it doesn't matter so much whether the stories are true or false in a very positivist way, right? Like, what matters is that there is a cultural relevance in the stories that we can connect to. And I'll close by mentioning Thomas King, who's a Native American or an Indigenous academic in Canada, who's written this wonderful book called The Truth About Stories, which tries to deal with this question through the, if you know Native American storytelling at all, the creation story is that the world sits on the back of a turtle, right? And he constantly plays this refrain through it, like, so what's the turtle sit on, right? Because I have to know, as a Westerner, I have to sort of know, so what does a turtle sit on for the stories to be valid, right? And his response is, a turtle. And what's that turtle sit on, right? And a turtle. And eventually he's like, get over it. It's turtles all the way down, right? The stories are still valid. It doesn't matter if you have that factual thing at the beginning, the stories still matter, right? And how we respond to those stories still matters in some way, even if we don't know that there's a factual basis in them, right? And so the way children respond with joy to learning about the world, whether what they learn is true or not, I think is a possible source of redemption for us. And if we listened and learn from kids more often, rather than try to mechanically steer them to a product that we think is going to be successful in the world that we've built, I think we'd start to see a pathway to escape. Go ahead.
No, I love it. And alas, I do have to go as well, but I've enjoyed every second of it. I think children is a big deal. I think for me, paying close attention to the kind of motivational or way that children pay attention or attend to the world is what you want to channel. And they seem to go through school and lose that. And that's the big thing. And there's something about story that is very big. I think basically what happened is there was a more story-based society led to violent religious wars. So we tried to replace it with a universal language, such as facts or mathematics or commodity. That leads to reductionism. And now the question is, how do we tell a better kind of story, or a story that is not going to lead to those conflicts? That is the address. That's what I think we have to get into. I think locating it, I think there is something about also this question of how do you have a real fiction or authoritative fiction, right? Like if you say, oh, you're a Christian, but God doesn't exist. Well, believing it's authoritative means you forgive your enemies. How do you have a story that compels you to forgive your enemies or to do things you don't want to do when you don't want to do them, right? Well, that's the problem with if it's a fiction. You can say, well, it's made up of just my beliefs. I don't have to do it. Like the real challenge today is having stories like religious stories that would have enough authority over you to compel you to do things you don't want to do, such as it's not easy to deal with difference or to pluralism or people who think differently than you, right? That goes against what's kind of the natural lizard brain thing. Well, Jesus is like, well, you got to forgive your enemies. You got to die on the cross. I don't want to. Well, I made the universe, so get over it. Okay. If you don't have that, but then the problem is that can lead to you killing people or taking over
Yeah, I
nations,
mean,
right?
I gotta push back because, again, if we listen to children, right? Children love hearing stories from other cultures. Children love learning that other kids do this in their home, right? Like, it's we as adults who get nervous about what's going to happen to our kids if they learn a story other than ours. And I think that's captured really well in Chimamanda Achebe's Danger of a Single Story TED Talk that she did, right? That like the problem is that we want to insist that there is a single story as opposed to a more ecumenical approach that says there's something valuable to learn in stories from lots of different cultures. And they don't all reduce to the same thing in the way the end of the 18th century thought they did, right? That like every religion on the world is basically Christianity in a different nutshell, right? It's not that. It's that like you can actually re really learn some fascinating things by listening to a story from a Native American elder, or by looking at the stories of Muhammad's life that are relayed in the Quran, right? That like you don't have to be a Muslim for those stories to be authoritative, right? And I don't see that as much of a problem if we really embrace a childlike attitude toward novelty, discovery, diversity, right? As opposed to getting settled in our ways as we get older.
No, I think that's exactly right. The issue is we come from I was talking about the trivia school set, like true, false, Christianity, true, everything else, false, dangerous to interact with false, because what if I give the answer wrong in the test? But in response to story, like you say, kids, the key that I think you're getting at with the phenomenology of the child is they see difference as exciting. So the key to me, what you were saying about the response, that may be getting at what needs to occur. Like the binding principle is the response to the story, not story. But you need story for the response. And you see, you could say before the Enlightenment, it was the story that was the unifying principle, led to the religious wars, et cetera, so forth. So we're like, we'll replace story with language, universal language, mathematics, facts, and so on and so forth. Well, that's not going to work. Well, then what's left? Okay, what about response to the story? The response itself being the thing you train universally, that then you have difference, but what's shared is the same kind of response of the difference to difference, right? And that is where I think you see the child and the creative and the artist, because the artists, like, they read all these books of different religions and they find it exciting, right? They don't find it threatening. So there, what to me, the emphasis on the response, or like Luba would emphasize, the allowing of the unfolding of being. I think the other difference is the Western mind looks for potential, as opposed to what we should do is observe the unfolding excess of things, the life vibrancy of the thing that is there. Potential has actually become a problem because you say that the realest thing is the potential, but potential is a reductionist, right? Really, no. Everything, this everything that is actual entails a lot more beyond the actuality that is excess, not potential, beyond you. But you have to observe it for that excess to unfold. And a story has that unfolding excess that the excitement is the response to. And so when you move the Western mind for looking for potential, because that's what we do with money. Oh, that's potentially $200. These are potentially the meanings of the story, are these symbols, right? You move away from that and say, allow the thing to unfold and I will respond to it. And that phenomenology, if you will, or universal response, that seems to be what needs to be taught that can help us deal with the problem of global pluralism, which I do definitely think is embodied in children. You don't like children, they just respond to the unfolding. They respond to the excess of the thing. And that's how you can get backstory, in my opinion, but not fall into the as much into the religious war, because you're bringing back the story to focus on the response to the stories, which that can be what you focus on the universal ground. So I appreciate you saying that so elegantly, because I think that helped crystallize a lot.
Yeah, beautifully put, gentlemen. And I'm really pleased, surprised where we've ended up. I really felt we've been on a on an arc and ended up somewhere much deeper than simply deconstructing what's gone wrong. The return to story is really something I'm feeling that was coming through here. And I was listening to Michael Mead, who's a wonderful storyteller. He does a podcast on myth recently, and he was talking about that there's this way in which stories can hold the wisdom when culture kind of goes astray or we kind of lose track. There's this way in which we return to not to facts, but to stories, and that we know that on some level, stories contain this. And I think we are seeing a return to story now that is not characterized by a singularity of story. The people who are really getting into myth telling are drawing from stories from different cultures, and the same capacity that allows them to really engage and respond to the Native American story is what allows them to engage and respond to the Christian story. And the beauty of Tolkien and the power of Tolkien, to my mind, is that, I have a friend from university who's an imam, and he loves Lord of the Rings. And Lord of the Rings is embedded with this mixture of Christian sentiment and also of kind of like Anglo-Saxon, pagan, northern people's kind of energy as well. And yet Lord of the Rings kind of presents that universality in which the deep sentiment and the sacramentality is, it's all there. There's so much sacredness in Lord of the Rings, and there's so much fractality of history. It's like history's going all the way back. It's not just like, oh, and then there was the Big Bang. It's like, no, this, you go behind the story, there's another story, and there was the Age of Numenor, and then there was this mythology behind the mythology, and so on and so forth. And so that's the kind of level of richness that I think we have to strike for. So with that, I know you gentlemen have to run, so we'll wrap it up here for today, and give you my thanks for another very, very captivating journey.
Always a pleasure. I it was a thrill. Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Jacob. It's
Indeed.
always a
Yeah.
treat.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Have a good one.
All the best.
Next time. Bye bye.